Today is Monday, April 17th, 2023. This is part 5 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Scott Imsland. Scott spells his last name I-M-S-L-A-N-D. And my name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Scott. How are you today?
All is well. All is going good at this moment.
Good. I'm happy. Glad to hear it. Scott, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you so much. You mentioned last time and recounted your first rowing river trip through the Grand Canyon. Might have been 72, might have been 71, not quite sure. And then after we stopped the interview, we talked about what to talk about next, which was your next Grand Canyon river trip. So can you pick that story up?
Yeah, I'll back up just a little bit in that my first training trip, I rode everything was coming into lava, and we had scouted it, and I was going to row it with Jerry Jordan's assistance behind me on the load. And as we entered the appropriate spot to the left of the falls, and it was high water, and as I entered the line that I needed on the left side that was going to probably go over somewhat of a pour over, but we'd be safe from the falls and the wall at the bottom.
Yeah.
So as we were heading over that area right there, I looked over to Gary Kelly, who was all on the far right side. And I think he must have got a hold of that, as I thought about it, the V-wave on the right side, and it took his snout, and he hit that really hard. And it sent him up in the air, and it spun him around, and he flipped right there. So I was looking across the top of Lava Falls in my snout boat with Jerry behind me, and I watched Gary Kelly flip. And I don't think Jerry was really paying attention to what was going on that side where the V-wave is. And so I turned around to him, and I said, "Gary just flipped his snout rig on the right side. You've got to jump in and take over because there's going to be some rescue involved, and I don't know really what's going on. I haven't seen lava before." So Jerry hopped in, I hopped out, and we headed down. My line was good, left side of the ledge hole, not anywhere as close to the ledge hole, but we were in a good line.
Good.
So we made it down through, and then we picked up Gary and he got his boat to shore, and those rigs are pretty heavy and awkward, so it's always a bit of a function and feat to right and get to shore a snout rig, especially at high water. So, yeah, that's where we kind of left off. And I finished off that trip running everything except for lava. And so we got home, and that probably was the trip that we went all the way to South Cove. And that's where our takeout was at the time. And then, and I talked about this earlier, that it took a long time for people to figure out Diamond Creek was the best place to get out outside of having flash flooded.
Or Diamond or Pierce Ferry. Why was Diamond the better takeout?
The better takeout is because you were closer to the town above Diamond Creek. I can't remember the name
Peach,
of that.
Peach Springs.
Yeah, okay, up at Peach Springs. That was closer to, like, you know, getting out from Flagstaff and heading over. And Diamond Creek, outside of, I don't even know if we paid a fee to the Hualapais at that time in doing this. We just kind of, oh, we're going to go down Diamond Creek and pick the boats up.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so I think Pierce's Ferry was, you know, across the vast desert as well as South Cove. You know, there's a lot of open space out there. It was a long trip, and it was a hot trip. So going down Diamond Creek Road to the takeout, it shortened everything. And I think everybody was interested in shortening all they could on takeouts and getting gear back and so forth. And our trip would end sooner, too.
Okay.
Which is either an advantage or a disadvantage to the people. But
right,
they paid to go from the beginning to Diamond Creek, and that was when we started taking out there.
Okay.
And it worked out pretty well, except for the floods. Lots of stories on the floods. So.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's that. Now, if you would like me to pick up, I finished that trip off. We went to South Cove, headed out home from there. And then we got back and we were to go right out on a trip. And whoever was in charge of sending boats and people and getting everything coordinated, they turned to me and they said, Scott, we need a boatman for this trip, and you're going to be rowing your own boat on this trip, your first trip. You'll have your own boat, and which is, I don't think they could ever do that now. I think it's like a minimum of 3 trips and probably some other incidental training of some nature. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, they turned to me and they said, are you ready to take a boat out? Because we need somebody to take a boat out. I said, yeah, I can do it.
And
let's go.
So as a trainee, did you get any pay for that trip?
I didn't get pay that I can recollect for my training trip.
Yeah.
But certainly I was on the payroll after I took the boat. So.
And what was your, what were you making?
Oh gosh, I think this would be a guess because I don't recollect. But it's probably like $110 a trip or something like that. And you're out there for so many days and that doesn't end up to be much money.
Now, you had mentioned the pay on the Middle Fork, Maine,
the Middle Fork Salmon.
Yeah, Middle Fork Salmon. I forget what that was. And
it was only like about $75, $80, something like that.
Okay. And so was the pay more because this was a longer trip?
I would say it was a longer trip. It got more revenue because more people went on it. The motor rigs took a lot of people, and we took at minimum 6 people on the snout rigs or the shorty pontoons. So
okay.
There was more money made by the company, and you know, it's a whole different thing. It's a longer trip for the boatman, and there's a lot of stuff that can go on. I think they were paying also, even though none of it was very much money, but they were paying for what you're going to go through for 3 weeks down there. So.
Mm-hmm. And also, thinking about that, were you getting tips in the early 70s, both in the Pacific Northwest and at Grand Canyon?
Yeah, absolutely.
And how did they compare?
I would say the Grand paid more on tips, and the Middle Fork trips were only 7 days.
So,
they weren't out long, but they did the full thing out to the Maine salmon. So it was a great trip, 7 days. It was lighter on the boatmen; they weren't out all the time.
Right.
You know, come home, go out. Come home, go out. You know, so it was not bad doing 7 days. And then when you get to the Grand, and you're doing, you know, whatever that was, 15 days, 18, 20 days, something like that. And, it was like 3 weeks, I think, out. And so anyway, the money didn't amount to much. But
okay.
You got fed and you had, you know, a place to wash your clothes and get your life together. So you just saved your money and
mm-hmm.
and that was how I did it.
Yeah, okay. All right, so without batting an eye, when they said, you're going out on the next trip, you leave tomorrow, you're rowing your own boat, you said?
I said, yeah, I'm ready to go. That's fine. And I think they gave me, I might have, because I rode the shorty pontoons quite a bit before they finally got rid of that as not a practical thing. It's killing people's backs, my back, everybody. It was very difficult work rowing those big rigs with a lot of people. So they probably gave me a shorty pontoon to start out. And, I was pretty excited, and I was pretty, in a positive way, shocked that I had just arrived, did my training trip, got back to the warehouse, and was going right back out with the responsibility of all the people and my boat and getting down and remembering where rapids were. And I had said earlier that there was still a tremendous amount of learning going on in the Grand Canyon by boatmen, where campsites were, how the rapids changed with various levels of water, the winds, when the dam, you had to learn all about the dam and its flow and when things change and be ready for, you know, low tides at some point in the day or nighttime, and when they might turn the spigot on, you're going to get a ton of water, so you don't want to have your boats not tied off well. That was another thing, is that the flows were so quasi-unpredictable, and it was really important to make sure your boats were tied up as if you never want to lose it. We'd tie all our boats side by side, plus to shore, so you never knew what was going to happen, and there was a great deal of, and that, if you're leading a trip, you would go and make sure all the boats, when it got dark, before it got dark, you would go out and make sure all the boats were tied up safely and check everything and make sure everything was above high water and your, where you were moored, that you were not going to be on a big boulder or a sharp pyramid of a rock out there. So, mm-hmm. And what it was going to bang into. Also, that's another part of getting your boat tied up safely, was that you're typically just in an eddy there, tied up to shore around a boulder or whatever. But you wanted to make sure during the night, and you might put in a rubbing mat of some sort too, because your boat is going to follow the eddy around to a certain extent, not a lot, but you're going to bang and bang and bang, and things could change all through the night. Sometimes, a lot of times I just slept on my boat, so I would know kind of what was going on out there.
Okay.
If I had to tie it off differently or snug up another boat to me or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So there's a lot of stuff. This only gets back to pay and competency out on the river, is that you have a lot of stuff to think about and a lot of issues that could crop up. And and that goes as far as storms, like at Legends Camp, storms come in and we had rivers of water coming down off the walls through the camp, and then also rocks were falling off of the cliffs when there was that much water and storm. So there's a lot of stuff to deal with in Grand Canyon to make it a safe trip and take care of people. So
mm-hmm. Okay.
That's about it there.
So on that second trip of yours, do you remember mm-hmm. Who were the other guides?
Gary Winburn, I believe, who I worked with in Idaho, he was also a fellow that was grabbed from Idaho to start training in Grand Canyon. Gary Winburn. So I knew him from Idaho and the Selway on the very first dramatic Selway trip in flood. He was the head boatman on that one.
Okay.
And then he moved to Grand Canyon, and it turned out that he was going to be leading the trip.
Oh, cool.
For Grand trip. So that was good, because it was somebody I knew and I'd worked with, and we'd done some hazardous trips together. So
cool.
He was not somebody that was light on safety or light on just how you approach the river and everything. He was very competent in making sure the trip got down safely. And if young kids were in the trip and says, you got to run run that hole over there. We got to hit that. Let's hit that. And you get that all the time on trips by macho kind of guys and so forth. And sometimes I did go to what they wanted if it was safe, like in Hermit. And I felt the flows were fine. I would go and hit it as hard as I could and have people, hanging on really strong up in the bow. And one time there was a chance at Hans, where the water was at a good level to go kind of dead center down through it. And that was really fun. But I very rarely did something for kicks down there. It was mostly get the boat down safely and all in one piece to shore for lunch and for our campsites and so forth. So it's a pretty remote place. We never had radios that worked. So you didn't want to screw up in the Grand Canyon, because at that time there was no way to get help other than go, all the way down to Phantom if you were miles upstream of that, or I don't know. You had to be really careful on the ground. And so as my first trip, Gary Winburn was the head boatman. And honestly, I don't remember the other folks on that trip, but they all were not brand new. Everybody had been down. So I was rowing my own boat, but everybody else had done probably a few seasons at least down there.
So this would have been Gary's second season at Grand Canyon?
I believe it would have been his second season, because he did not come to Idaho the second time.
Okay.
So he's already out there.
All right.
Yeah. And and that's all I can think about right now.
If you were rowing a snout, Shorty, mm-hmm. Were the other guys rowing the same kind of boat? I mean, at what point did people start transitioning into, you know, the more typical 18-foot-long bucket boat type arrangement with four passengers instead of the snout with six?
Yeah. I was still rowing snouts on my second season, but the shorty pontoons, I stopped after my first season, and they found out that the snouts work so well that there's no sense in bringing a big boat like that down that was clumsy, and we really didn't take any more people in that shorty than we did in the snout rig. So those kind of dropped out of the whole deal.
Okay.
That was good. So that was my second year. I didn't row shorty pontoons, and it was all snouts. And then eventually, another year or two down the line, is when I started rowing an Avon Pro, and there were other normal small trips that had the smaller boats. And we just finally graduated out of this. It wasn't overkill, because I think those boats were really good. The snout rig was really good.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was a very capable, well-designed boat, kind of a spur-of-the-moment development of it, and we tested it. And those were the boats that went and were given to MNA when I went over to work for them. So I continued to row.
Okay.
I continued the snout rigs, which could carry a lot of gear, and sometimes we'd put a few more people on it if the scientists needed to go, if we had more people, whatever.
Yeah.
But for commercial stuff, I walked away from the snouts and started on more of the 8-man boats, which would carry six. Actually, we still carried six people on the small boats now. At that point.
Okay. All right. Sorry about that. Yeah. Okay. So Gary was leading that second trip. Anything else you remember about it?
No. Not anything significant other than we talked about this a little bit before, and that was getting surprised at how little was known about campsites and where to take hikes. And being on the second trip, you know, it was still such a developmental period that I just learned just the feel of what's going on down there, and amazing how when the trip would end, people would talk about the various hikes that they had done, and they found a new campsite that could handle a full trip. And so I think it was mostly just amazed at how we would be floating along. And even I couldn't remember a lot of these turns and twists, and they go, oh yeah, last time, didn't we camp over there? And he goes, yeah, but we found another spot that's probably better. Mm. And we found another canyon to hike in. And so we can time it to get that hike in and still get to that new campsite that we've discovered somewhere.
Right.
And so it was very interesting just getting a hold of what's going on.
Okay.
Really down there.
And there were a number of other companies running trips by 1971. A lot of them were motorized. Hatch was down there, and
yeah,
Georgie was down there, and Western was down there.
Western was down there.
So did you communicate with those people when they would go by, say, where are you going to camp? Was that happening?
All the time.
Okay.
All the time. There was never nothing was set up from the shore with a park. Park Service was so non-existent for the first few years. So there, we would all talk. Everybody was very friendly. Nobody tried to scam anybody or take a spot. Or if there was a spot like a Deer Creek where two camps could happen, they said, "Yeah, we're going down to Deer Creek, but we'll save the upper one for you." Or they would always kind of go, "This one would be better. This campsite would be better for you guys. We'll take the one that suits us, okay, but it would be hard for you." So they were very. Everybody was very helpful.
Okay.
And then. Another thing at the time, this is kind of interesting that nobody really talks about, is that Fort Lee had a rafting company,
right?
Fort Lee Company, and the little canteen store that had Odds and Ends was right at Lee's Ferry. There were trailer homes there at Lee's Ferry. And if you were lucky enough to make friends with somebody, you know, whatever, whether it's a girl or some guys are down there, you could also, if you came on a trip early and you're going to spend the night, well, you always spent the night, but sometimes, you know, you could be lucky enough to get in on a rainy night into somebody's trailer and spend the night there. And if there are last minute things that you forgot at the warehouse, the little store there might have it. And so, yeah, that was something. And then finally, I suppose somehow Fort Lee sold their permit, I suppose, to somebody. They were gone. The trailers were gone. And the little store cafe was gone. And that was all at that early time. First trip, second trip, it was all there. And then by the third trip, it was kind of all dismantled, which was kind of curious time right then.
So that was that summer of 71, 72.
71 was active, 72 active still, 73 starting to dismantle the whole thing.
All right.
But that probably is also when the talk about getting rid of motors was going on, which was a big battle for all the big commercial trips
and
people going to rowboats. And that's why we had these big rowing rigs that we were experimenting with so that the revenue stayed high if we got rid of motors for Arda.
Right.
So, anyway.
Okay. Do you remember Tony Sparks? He was the operator of Fort Lee and he would have been there at that time.
I wouldn't say I know that name and I wasn't like friends with any of those people, but I remember the name, and he was running that stuff. And then there's Tour West was there, and Hatch was there, and Western was there, and we were there. Arda was there. I probably got to the point where there were quite a few outfitters that were found out they could get permits or bought permits, and that was a lucrative business.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the Dories were running right then, too. So.
Right. Right.
So,
okay.
A lot of people. But
It was. It was already up and running, and of course, crowding in the canyon was first mentioned in the 1940s. So we won't go into that. You're right. Fort Lee had that operation going at Lee's Ferry, and then they closed that up. After your trip with Gary, did you go out again that season?
Oh yeah, So I'd done the time in Idaho. So we're moving through the summer.
Wait, Scott. I'm sorry. How was your rowing through Lava Falls on that trip? Do you remember that at all with Gary?
Oh, yeah, sure I do. Sure I do. And so everybody knew that everything was new to me down there. And they really loved it. And I had a great group of passengers. And I was very, it was a fun story to tell. And they really appreciated it. Wow. This is your first time with your own boat. Wow, congratulations, blah, blah, blah. And it was kind of like, I'm just going to kind of keep an eye on things and watch where the guy in front of me is going. we'll get down and we'll figure it out. And then eventually, as we got farther and farther down, I said, you know, now we probably got a whole different group of people that came in at Phantom because sometimes you didn't carry the Lee's Ferry people all the way down.
But, oh.
You know.
So that was that was a full exchange, what, on day 7 or day 6, something like that?
Yeah, halfway down, about 7 days they got. 7 days, and then they would hike out. And then we would get passengers who hiked down. And then we'd also have the full trip people. And so everybody knew by the time I was getting near Lava Falls that I had yet to run it. And it was just kind of a comical, you know, joke about the situation that I had yet to row through it, but I had seen what happens when you don't do it successfully. So I know what that's all about.
Okay.
And so, and then at that time, we were also learning about the bubble line, and that didn't exist for, you know, the beginnings of the commercial stuff. Rowing. I mean, you had a motor rig. You just kind of plowed down the right side or went left, which we did a lot, go left. And then
and what's her name would just go straight over the falls.
Georgie.
Georgie would just, there we go, bang. You know, it's just horrific. But we finally found the bubble line, which turned out to be just a fantastic way to dodge a lot of stuff. But it was frightening. Are you familiar with the bubble line and
yes.
where it lines up and all that?
Yes.
Okay. So when you push off and start drifting down, it was always a little bit of a matter. Of course, the current could change bubble line a little bit, but basically it was always there. But it was always interesting as you pushed off. The unknown was clearly in your face, and you hoped that you were reading everything properly, and because you go right by the right corner of the falls. And I never felt like we ever got sucked from the bubble line over to the falls, but it was always exciting of a test of yourself and your nerves and where you were at, and you know, should I bail and do something different, or I don't think I'm in the right spot, I'm going to go against the wall, or whatever you're thinking. But it was always interesting and a mental challenge, and your method of reading where you were at and where you're in the right spot. And because once you line up and take on the bubble line, it's like whoosh, you are locked in, and you're not locked in to go over the falls. There's no rowing involved at this point. You're just on the bubble line. Maybe your snout rig and your left tube is on the bubble. That was something people had to figure out for themselves. And
So Scott, I'm familiar with this, but and you are too. But people who are listening to this interview may not be. Can you explain, you know, what the bubble line looks like? What can you see of the rapid as you push away from shore? Are you on the right side or left side of the rapid? Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. Yeah. When you go through lava, you typically check it out from the right-hand side. There's a well-traveled trail up to a little bluff that you kind of watch where things are going and make a decision. And then there are times when you, water level wise, you might pull in on the left side and walk down to the rapid and see what that left run was like, which was my first trip run with the left side, not the right side, not the V wave, not the bubble line, hadn't been found yet. But you push off from shore, and it's not untypical as when you're in your boat and you're floating down, you just kind of see on your horizon a thin line and spray from the pounding of the falls and slamming the cliffs or whatever. So you see a line, and so you're really, it's very challenging to keep your bearings. And what you were looking for as you got closer, you're running out of time to make any maneuvers, but you have walls on your right side and just nothing but the ledge hole on the left and other holes down below. So as you're going down, you're standing up, which is what pretty much everybody, at least I did it all the time. You stand up to get some perspective because all you see is spray and a sharp line across your horizon. So you stand up, and as you come and you feel the momentum starts to pick up and the boat, the current is starting to go quicker. And then you will get a glimpse of what the bubble line is, which is just a series of lined up boils, more so, gurgling boils. And you would just put, you know, whatever you think was best for you, either your left tube or center of your boat, or I would never put my right tube on it. You get way too much boat close to the ledge hole. But, standing up, watching for the bubbles popping up, but they were little whirlpool things from the current and the collision by whatever under the water. And it was a very, then you drop from there. Once you were lined up, you would make your big drop and you could look to your left and see the pit of the ledge hole and the falls right there as you're dropping into this little rapid of its own, like just next to the lava falls. And you would make that fall, and everybody's hanging on, and I never lost any. I don't remember people getting lost at that impact, but so you just had everybody hang on, and it wasn't like you were hitting crystal or hermit or anything, but it was a sharp while you went down, you hit some recoiling wall at the bottom, rooster tails, and then you were on your way down. And then the next thing you worried about was the V wave on your right, where Gary Kelly slipped, and at certain water levels, you probably don't want to do that, the right-hand side for the V wave. But sometimes at lower water, it was a good selection. And then once you get through the V wave and your bubble line run, and then you're getting close to the right-hand wall. Well, it's not, I guess it is a wall and boulders and stuff. And then at the very bottom is a big black rock. And that thing, you can flip. I flipped my dory on that wall of water that would smash off of the black rock at the bottom on the right. And also, the problem with dealing with that big black boulder at the bottom on the right, the big lava piece, was water actually, there was a little tunnel just because of where the big boulders had landed, so that if somebody had to, somebody flipped and swam, I had heard of people going through the tributary with that big black rock on the right-hand side. I'd never want to put myself through that. But I think somebody has had it happen to them when the boat flipped or a passenger went through it.
Uh-huh.
And once you're done with that, when you're done and you haven't flipped on the black rock, or you haven't lost a passenger, or a passenger hasn't, in your flip, gone through that channel, then you're pretty much in just speedy water and no rapids, and then you come down to lower lava on the wall down there, which can push your boat up sideways onto. So you got to kind of make sure you're being mindful of where your currents are taking you with the wall at the bottom on the left side. But after that, then you're pretty much done. And it's time to party and go to your campsite if it's that time, and you figure it's good enough. We've made miles, and yeah, that was pretty much it. Once you went through lava and you made it through lower lava, it was off to your campsite, and everybody's happy and had a beer and congratulated everybody on good runs, and we all made it. And all the people are so hyped up with lava falls from reading about it, or TV, or talks, the onshore talks about what's coming up. And of course, there's lava fall. And the night before at campsite, that's really built up. Lava falls, not necessarily build up, but kind of like, well, tomorrow's a big day, so we're going to be doing this. And once we get through lava, you know, all the major rapids are done. But, yeah, that's what we're looking forward to tomorrow. So make sure everybody gets their gear wrapped up so we can load up and have a shot at it not too late in the day. So that was it. That's how people got really jacked up about lava. And there were times the water wasn't very high, and lava was a big letdown. And so people have spent their whole life reading and seeing videos of lava falls, and they come there, and it's, you know, not much of anything. And, I mean, to us, it was nothing. To them, they might sense something out of it. But most of the time, there was a good wild run through it, safe wild run. But there were many times when the water just wasn't cooperating, so it was kind of a dud of a rapid, and they made the best of it. And
okay.
We were done.
Yeah. And you had a good run.
Yeah.
Cool.
The only thing I ever happened to me was that I flipped the dory in the V-wave at the bottom right.
And let's hold that story until we get to that year.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. That'll be good.
Yeah. Few years passed. Yeah.
So on that trip, your second trip, did you actually go out to South Cove, or did you short out at Diamond?
No, I think we went to Pierce's at that point.
Okay.
And
did you row all the way out to Pierce, or did a little boat come up, or did you have a motor? How'd you do that?
Yes. The Chevy engine open, you know, speedboat came out to pick us up, and he was always on time, always just what we needed. He would bring beer, and we'd have our boats that had spent the night floating down all tied together.
Okay.
From Bridge Canyon, and that's where...
So would you do that with the passengers, or were they on a different craft on the way out?
No, we all tied everything down, told them to get their sleeping mats out and that we would be spending the night floating.
Oh, wow.
We might be hitting walls. We might be going through any tamarisk bushes, trees that were sticking out.
Yep.
And it's going to be dark. Hold a flashlight out in case, you know, if something snags your sleeping bag or you get snagged over. It was an amazing risk to learn so much about Grand Canyon, and then you go, it felt like you never stopped learning down there, because now how are we getting off and where are we getting off? Oh, so, well, we're going to go out to Pearson's Ferry now, and a motorboat was going to come up and pull us in, and to get to that point so he doesn't have to drive, you know, maybe, I don't know how many miles that is, 20 miles, 25 miles with gas and so forth to get up to us. We tie all our boats together, rig everything out like we're, you know, going out for the day, and everybody will be sleeping on top of the loads, and we're going to push off from our last supper at Bridge Canyon, and we ate, finished loading, pushed off in the dark, had some flashlights, and said, okay, we might hit some walls, and there might be some brush, and we might get stuck in an eddy, so we might be rowing a little bit. So we had a person on the left and the right-hand side with the oars shipped into the boat, but one needed to get away or get out of an eddy, or you fall asleep, and you're going, God, we haven't gone anywhere, I don't think. And, you know, it's just, you got used to the darkness where you might be, what we have to do to keep this boat going. Because the motorboat that came up to get us would expect us much nearer Pearson's Ferry than being stuck up canyon. And that could happen, too.
Right.
I think there were times it was really low water, too, so there were some sandbars to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was amazing that we got away with everything. Not away meaning like we tricked somebody,
right,
but we risked so much stuff doing this. And it's like, wow, I mean, people could have fallen off, rolled off. We never had anybody roll off of the boat in the middle of the night, but anything could have happened, but it never did on the trips I was on.
And so Scott, how do you remember? I'm assuming there might be 4 or 5 or 6 snouts, and how did you...
On a trip at a time?
Yeah, how did you tie them all together? How many boats did you have, and what sort of configuration for the night float did you put them in?
Yeah, it was easy with the snout rigs to put them side by side.
Okay.
Tied up tight to side by side. The tubes were the same height, same length, basically. And you just made what they were made for, which was a bridge in the military.
Mm-hmm.
And so tying them together, it turned out just to be a bridge with the snouts turned up in the bow, and
yep,
the back was normal. And
so would you line them all up, or would you kind of have, you know, 2 in the front, 2 in the middle, 2 in the back, or how would you do that?
You know, that's a good question. It wasn't like there was a bunch of them on a trip. There might have been, I'm just guessing now, but maybe 4 snout rigs per trip. That would be 20-some-odd people. Yeah, it was probably like not any more than 5 for sure.
Okay.
And I just remember it was easier just to put them side by side.
Hmm.
And that gave people, so you got the whole trip in sleeping bags and pads. So you need property to put people on.
Right.
So, you know, it can't be like one long sausage going down there. It's, they're side by side, so you could walk, and it might be 15 feet worth of boat that you could walk, you know, across and back and forth. And then you're 18 feet from one end to the other, 18, 19 feet. So you had the stern, the bow, and then you needed all the distance you could get to house everybody. So,
right. Would you like, you know, I'm assuming you had some sort of tables with little pipe legs. Would you use those to have people, would you set those out somewhere for people to sleep on?
And yeah, in areas that were not comfortable or whatever, you might have 2 collapsible tables that would connect any kind of vacancies that needed to, you know, you didn't want to, I mean, I guess you could have also, if the bolts weren't tight and they sprung apart, I mean, somebody could slip down through something, I suppose, but they were put together as tight as we could.
Yeah.
But, yes, tables could have been stretched out and laid out where they were needed safety-wise, and they were really good to beds to lay on if you had, you know, your mats and your sleep. Also, the other thing is, you know, I can't recall if everybody had to have a life jacket on. I imagine they did. But I was going to say extra life jackets also filled in gaps and made it soft too. So
and down once down on the reservoir, the water from back up behind Hoover Dam called Lake Mead would back all the way into Grand Canyon. And on the reservoir, adults, 14 years and older, didn't need to wear a life jacket because there weren't any rapids.
Yeah. True. There was a point where life jackets weren't used, and that was also a period of time that a lot of times people didn't wear their jackets, and that was the same for Idaho, too, and I look at pictures. And,
oh, right.
And the outfitters there very rarely life jackets in Idaho.
So this is in Grand Canyon, up between Lee's Ferry and Bridge Canyon. If the water was flat water, placid, people would just take their jackets off.
Yeah.
Okay.
Clip them onto the boats. And if you saw a ranger, which was never down that far, and you didn't see many rangers anyway, but you would say, everybody get your jackets on. Of course, when we ran rapids, we weren't foolish enough not to have everybody buckled up.
Right.
But like, it's really hot down there, and as things got tighter in time, we all struggled with passengers that wouldn't wear their jackets. So if you got into the point where people were, you know, if they got to you enough times, they would break you and they didn't have to wear their jacket. And then, you know, Fred doesn't have to wear his jacket. Why do I have to wear mine?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's a real hassle once you start letting people get comfortable and undo their jackets. So, but it was really the Wild West with a lot of that stuff. Certainly in the beginning, it was, you know, who wanted to wear their jacket on a hot day and it was flat water. I mean, it wasn't like we were running through a whole bunch of mountain river rapids with pour overs and rocks and
logs
and all that stuff. It's pretty forgiving in a lot of ways, the Grand Canyon water-wise. People get drunk and fall in and drown, but, you know, people basically made it down.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
So,
okay. Well, cool. Thanks for talking through how that night float worked out, with the snouts.
Sure.
I was kind of wondering how that worked. So the second trip went well. Then what happened?
Second trip went well. And so, I still rode snouts as the next trip went out. And to tell you the truth, those extra trips that I ran, I don't remember nothing ever happened on any of those trips boat-wise. Nobody flipped. Oh, there's an interesting thing. Jerry Jordan, at some place, and I think it was maybe in Crystal, and it would have been about on my third trip. And he was in a shorty pontoon rowing, and he hit a sharp rock, and it took out the shorty pontoon. It's just like a big, long donut. It's not like a real boat-looking kind of thing. So if you lose a tube, the boat is going to sink. And so he hit something, and he ended up, the only way we could get that boat and the people, and we needed room to put people on. We couldn't lose a boat, and we needed boats to put people on instead of dumping a lot
Hang on, Scott. Let's go back here for a minute, make sure I understand this. The shorty pontoon is a 20-some foot long oval, and the floor has been cut out of it, and it has frames hanging in that center area. So if he hits a rock and it slices down the one side of the boat, the other side's still fine and it's still going to hold air because there are baffles in this in these chambers. You'd lose a couple of chambers, and that would then drop. That would drop, and so the whole thing would sort of turn sideways, but it wouldn't sink. It would just kind of go down the river sideways. But you got no oars, you can't steer it. It's kind of out of control, and off you go.
Yeah, it was like, well, what are we going to do? And Jerry just decided it wasn't something that could be fixed. And he and I guess our crew decided the best thing is to not have the thing dangling down in the water. We're going to tie everything that's soggy out of air and has gone flat. We're going to tie it all to the other side that wasn't cut or whatever, and the valves were working. And so everything that was deflated and unusable and unfixable, it was just tied up. And so this crazy-looking raft that was out of symmetry and still having to carry people, it was, that was one of the things that just one of the anomalies that occurred, and lost half your boat. You tied.
Help me to figure this out. If he had taken out the front part of the boat where the oval is, or the back part where the oval is, then I can understand that would just simply be wrapped up against the frame, and it would look ugly, but it would still float. Is that kind of what we're talking about?
I think that's a good point you're bringing up, because I remember it as being goofier than just the front, but it could have been, like there are chambers, like you were talking about, and valves between each one of the chambers. So it could have been that the front of that boat was deflated, and it went to a point where the walls inside the tubes didn't allow air to be lost. But I also, everything, in order to make it work, it seemed like the whole one side and the bow of the thing had to all be kind of tied up so it wasn't being drug along and wasn't, bent underneath the boat. And you still had to row this thing.
Yeah, right.
You kind of had to make it rowable in some way. So whatever had deflated and was not usable anymore couldn't be let go in the water to not only collect water in that deflated tube to drag you along.
Right.
It was mostly just a big joke. We couldn't, what else could we do? We couldn't do anything.
Right.
We lost it. And it wasn't a boat that could be easily.
Was there another shorty pontoon on the trip? Could you put sort of made a triple rig out of it with one tube down the middle and an outrigger? I don't know. I'm just thinking.
Yeah. No, there was no more shorties. I mean, they were on the phasing out stage at that point.
All right.
And so with snout rigs and probably people that wanted to try out the regular whitewater rafts, for, 8-man, 6-man rafts. And so those were probably starting to get integrated in. So there was a point finally where the shorties, who would want to row them? Were so heavy, so hard.
And were you guys having two rowing stations on the shorties, or had that gone down to one?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. The stations that we talked about, there's one in the back and one about in the middle.
Right.
And I know that I rode those boats longer than most. I don't know if it was just for the security of thinking it was so big a boat that I could make it through all these horrible holes that I was being dropped into.
Uh-huh.
But I didn't mind the boat, and it you get so strong down there that you just adjust to everything, and you get better at keeping out of eddies, and you get better at everything. You just become a better boatman. Go ahead.
No, no, I was agreeing with you. I said, yeah, I bet. You get good at figuring out, oh, I don't want to get in that eddy. I got in there before. That was painful. Yeah.
Oh, terrible. Terrible. And everybody knows what to not play with, what eddy line not to go across, because you'll never get out. I mean, you'll spend the afternoon trying to get out. So we got eventually the shorties left the lineup. The snout started to take over, and then they started to blend in as kind of an experiment, I suppose, on everybody's part. Well, let's see if these, normal whitewater rafts
can handle Grand Canyon water. That was a big deal. What kind of boats can handle? We know motor rigs. That's why people use motor rigs. They're huge. They got a motor to put them in the right place.
Right.
They got a motor to power up over a big lip of some nature or around and away from a rock or whatever. So it was kind of like that was the period of time that you were looked at rowing boats. Ah, that's never going to work. You know, it was very much like a new novel thing. And I even have had a picture or have a picture of I think it was Western trying to row like a small, not even small, just kind of like imagine a bunch of snout rigs kind of tied together, and you could take more people. And this big guy named Hawk had these huge oars, and he pulled into Havasu. I had never seen anything like it. It was like a full-blown, could handle a tank during the war with the flotation in that thing. But everyone was trying to, or the owners of the company were trying to get as many people on the trip as they could. If they went to rowing, we needed to increase the number of people that we could get on a boat. And if that's making a boat bigger, that's what we're going to do. But eventually, politicians and so forth didn't make it go oar only. So
right. Right. We'll get into that. That's going to be coming along. But this is really, really fascinating because, you know, just thinking about the 50s, the 40s and 50s, where commercial people like Georgie, who started do-it-yourself and then moved into commercial, she was telling the Park Service the little rowboats can't work here. And the Park Service wanted to hear that because they didn't want do-it-yourselfers down there in little rowboats.
Yeah,
of course, they now, these days, there are tons of little rowboats down there.
Yeah.
They're all little, you know, personal playboats, and they're a lot of fun to drive around. But it was just fascinating to see the concept of we've got to have big boats, we got all these people, that's the vision of boating in the canyon.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And my time was exactly at the cusp of get rid of motor rigs. Everybody's going to row. And, of course, Martin Litton and the Dories could have carried lift. That was fine.
Right.
You know, I suppose that's what they thought. But I fully felt like it was all politics. And if it took politics by the owners of the permits to pay off the senators and congressmen and so forth to get rid of this idea of oar only down there. There's too much money, and it's only safe if you go in a motor rig, and it's only safe,
right?
You know, and what if this happens? That rowboat's, you know, they're going to flip, and you've got people all over the place, and
right.
They don't have, you know, there was everything, all the strategy to make sure motors stayed on the river, and that was not a mandatory rowing situation. So and that's what they won. They won it. And I remember them talking, you know, the whole vibe was like, and we felt it too, is like, how safe is it, you know, at high water to take a 6-7-8 man rowing boat that you would take on the Salmon or the Middle Fork? How safe is that? And I don't think anybody rowing knew how safe it was going to be. That's why the snout stuck around for so long. And finally, either people got softer or whatever. They go, no, we can get down with these normal whitewater boats.
And it's so funny because in the 50s, there were people down there in 7-man oar boats and paddle boats in these tiny little boats, all these do-it-yourself people. They were having
Absolutely.
A blast. And they
Absolutely.
Were rolling on through, and nobody was. And so it's just fascinating to see.
Yep.
In the commercial world, where you want you want to try to minimize your payment to your guides and
sure.
maximize your revenue with your passengers, makes perfect sense. A different vision, yes, and a political spin story. Interesting.
Yeah.
All politics, huh?
I saw, and I think we mentioned it before, maybe on Facebook or whatever. But I remember seeing. They might have been Christian or religious groups of some sort. I thought that's what they were all about. And they were like in
in truck tires blown up, all lashed together, and they were
really?
All floating down the river. And then there was the yaks, or there was a name, what are those?
The sport yaks.
Yeah, sport yaks. And there were sport yaks going down. And we were rowing, they were rowing, and they were like, they weren't high above the water. They were just a little boat. They were a little tiny boat.
Yeah.
And it would crack me up when I would see these people. And I go, God, what I've just been through, those guys made it. You know, I'd talk to them and say, how did this go for you? And how was House Rock? And how was this and that? And they were just, like you're talking, they were just gay and happy, you know. Yeah, we did good, you know. We made it.
Huh.
A lot of
Interesting.
Fun. Yeah, so.
Cool.
All going on before the even idea of kicking the motors off. That
right.
was going on before that idea came up. And actually, I don't know what precipitated get rid of the motors. I don't know if that was just ecological, the 60s or 70s, whatever. You know, let's get gas off the rivers or whatever. I don't know what started it all. But it had momentum for a while.
It did, yeah.
For the motor rigs.
Well, we've been happily visiting here for about an hour. Maybe this is a good time to put a comma in this interview series.
Yeah. I've got one question for you, and you want to punch it off, that's fine. Or, I don't know, I just was wondering if somebody ends up typing all this out or to stay as an oral, history people can listen to.
Oh, good. I'll answer that now. The recording is still going, so people know. We have volunteers that transcribe the oral histories into Word documents and then into PDFs, and those are downloadable on the website, and they go into long-term storage as well. But it's all volunteer, and we're kind of behind the transcripts.
Yeah.
So that's how it works.
Wow.
Cool.
And so the oral part of my talking and so forth, does that stay as a component that people could listen to, or is it
all? Oh, yes.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah.
I just thought, how the hell?
So people can read the transcripts, they can listen directly, and this is, typical handling of oral histories rolling forward. So that's
okay.
Good.
Yeah. I know nothing about all that, so.
Yeah,
anyway,
no, that's good.
That's all I have to say.
Okay, wonderful. Well, with that, let's conclude part 5 of A Grand Canyon Oral History with Scott Imsland. Today is Monday, April 17th, 2023. My name is Tom Martin, and Scott, thank you so very much.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun, as usual. We drop me back in the time machine, and I float through the clouds with all of my memory and lack of to describe what happened in those earlier years, moving on to the other farther out years of my experience down there.
No, you did well. Cool. Thank you. Hang on.
Okay.